It's starting to sink in today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This U.S.-based Lebanese reporter has already been confronted by Trump supporters, and she knows it could happen again.
I can't change how I look, I can't change my name, and I can't change my audience concerns about this.
And on this Veterans Day, we'll also hear from vets about this election.
We've endured much more difficult times. We've gone through civil wars and world wars and great depressions, and yet here we are. You know, we'll be okay.
Plus how Leonard Cohen won Israeli hearts during the Yom Kippur War.
This is special for many Israelis. Somebody come, a singer like Leonard Cohen come and perform during the war. Nobody do it.
That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on this Friday, Veterans Day. It's also the end of a long and divisive week here in America. Later in the show, the views of some veterans on the outcome of Tuesday's election. But first, we're going to talk about those anti-Trump protests that have been happening for the past 3 nights. Across the U.S., people have taken to the streets, including right here in Boston. In some cities, notably in Portland, Oregon, the protests have turned violent. We wanted to get an outsider's perspective on this, so with me is Joyce Karam. She's from Lebanon and is the Washington bureau chief for the pan-Arab newspaper Al Hayat.
Well, in the Middle East, from very early on, people in the Arab world have been mystified about this election, confused about what does Donald Trump stand for and what it all means for U.S. policy. Now, with the protests, I'm hearing more questions. Is this like the Arab Spring? Is this massive protests? Will they stop Donald Trump from becoming president? How long will they continue? Who are leading them? There are definitely so many questions. And I think this is a very sensitive period in the United States. It's very hard to explain for an Arab audience, given the level of polarization within the U.S. and the so many issues at play that are driving these protests. People are watching and waiting to see what to make of it, if this is really a temporary thing or if it becomes a new normal and goes on for a while.
I mean, I'd like to know what you think, because I can't recall a time when people protested an election in this country in the streets. What do you think the fact that they are happening at all says about the moment we're in now?
This is definitely unprecedented. As someone who had covered the George Bush administration, I'm having flashbacks from those days, but that didn't happen exactly after the election. It happened later because of policies. I think what we're witnessing is unprecedented level also of polarization within the U.S. between the right and the left. And I think this will keep playing on for a while. I do think this might be the new normal that we will see more in the Trump administration. The minorities and the coalition that's taking part in the protests, I do think many don't feel represented in this election. And the chance, not my president, I don't think they will be able to change the outcome of the election, but it's just a symptom of what to expect, at least in the year to come, of the Donald Trump presidency.
Let's consider for a moment, Joyce, the fear that some Muslims right now have that Donald Trump has been elected, a man who's talked about registering Muslims in the U.S., a ban on Muslims entering the U.S. What are you hearing from people in Beirut about all this?
Well, you know, Marco, yesterday morning, people were actually excited that the ban was removed from the website. And then a few hours later, it's back on the website, and we are told it was just a technical glitch. So I don't think the anxiety is gone yet. I think that there are serious concerns. We're also seeing a spike in hate crime after the election against minorities and veiled Muslim women. I read that two women were attacked in California on university campuses. So I think the proof will be in the pudding. What will happen under President Trump? I know that his campaign has reached out to Arab governments, to Muslim governments, assuring them that Trump, the campaigner, will not be Trump, the president. He has nothing against Muslims and is looking forward to working with them. Will that materialize, or will we see more also leaning on the base, on the far right base that's very charged in, you know, anti-Muslim tone and Islamophobic slogans? I think that remains to be seen. But I think if Trump wants to have his way, he could have a good working relationship with the Muslim world.
This is kind of a sensitive topic, but I know that while you were covering the Republican National Convention, there was one moment where you lied about your ethnicity. Would you tell us about that moment?
Yes, it was in the Republican National Convention, and we were seated. Ironically, we were seated with the supporters, not in the journalists' booth. Me and a couple of other Arab journalists, and I just went to walk to get a drink, and someone saw me, and he was like, "Oh, where are you from? I mean, you can't see me right now, but I do have black hair. It was summer. I was darker." And in the heat of the moment and having seen everything we were seeing in Cleveland, from white supremacists protests, from carry-on guns protests, I felt afraid and honestly terrified. And I just said, India. You know, So I did lie, but it was just, I did not want to have an argument of, you know, being called to get out of the, go back to the Middle East, or being labeled as a bad Muslim or anything of that sort. I mean, it was, I've covered so many conventions, but that experience at the RNC, I'm not sure I will be witnessing anything like this in American politics again.
So as a journalist in the United States and covering the story, and, you know, you're from the Mideast, are you worried about kind of the experience you had at the Republican National Convention kind of becoming a trope for maybe the next 4 years?
That is a concern. And I mean, also, if you see the attitude from the Trump campaign in addressing foreign journalists, that's also a concern. It was not easy to get into some of his rallies. There's not equal respect for foreign journalists. Definitely the Middle East is even harder. But I am hoping that the next few weeks, as the transition goes on, that there will be more openness in the process, that we will actually be able to reach out to his officials and the administration here in D.C., and that the labels that we saw during the campaign on Arabs, on Muslims, that we might be able to turn this page. Otherwise, it will be a complete nightmare to cover this. I can't change how I look. I can't change my name, and I can't change my audience concerns about this. Just hoping that the mood will change within the administration now that the Republicans have a clear majority.
How hard will it be for you, Joyce, to actually get a one-on-one interview with Donald Trump, do you think? Is that something you want to do, sit down with him and ask him a few questions?
I would love to, and I think he seems to be more open to the media, but let's see. I mean, I'm not on the top of that list. We will have to wait and see what kind of outreach he will bring to the Arab world, and if that's at all on his list.
Well, Joyce Karam, a Washington bureau chief for the newspaper Al Hayat, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here's another look at the election from someone who's just arrived in the U.S. His name is Naz. That's the only name he wants to use since he's concerned for his safety. Naz is from Afghanistan and worked as an interpreter for the U.S. Marines. That work triggered death threats from the Taliban, forcing him to leave. After years of waiting, he finally got a visa and now lives in the Boston area. Naz says his life here is good so far, and yet he's worried about being sent home now that Trump's been elected.
It was really hard for me to get to the United States, and right now it's been just a couple months or 2 months, and now I have a scared that I will be sent back to Afghanistan.
You worked as an interpreter for the U.S. Marines. Do you hope that will be kind of something that will allow you to stay here, that will give you a certain privilege?
Yeah, I think that because I work for the government and I'm like a special immigrant here to United States, but I don't know. I still have scared. I don't know what will happen. Because the first thing that I'm a refugee and the second I'm a Muslim. So I don't know what will happen with me.
Right. I mean, you went to protests this week against President-elect Donald Trump. Tell us why.
Some of my friends, they invite me there. And they make some sign that we stand for refugee. And they are supporting refugee. They work for the refugee. They're living here in Boston. So they invite me. They say it will be a good opportunity for you if you want to join this protest. So I go with them too. And we had a sign that we are stand for refugee.
I mean, that is one of the things about the United States. We do have freedom of assembly and people can go out and protest. So what was it like for you to go out in the streets of Boston and protest this election?
Like, this was my first time. I heard that America is like free speech country and everyone have the rights, what they want to say. But I think I'm not allowed because I'm just new here. But I go there just for to support for the refugee.
Were you worried at all?
I worried for the refugee. Like refugee, like people say, seeking asylum is a human rights. So we're looking for the human rights. So I just go for that to support refugee.
Were you worried for yourself?
Yes, I worried for myself.
You know, Donald Trump has called for extreme vetting. How hard was it to get your visa to the United States?
Oh, that was a long process, security process, and it's been like 3 years. I applied in 2013, 1st of January. So it's been 3 years that I waited for, and lots of screening, lots of fingerprints, lots of interview. And like in embassy, they ask me for the all police record certification, like the criminal certificate. I must bring like one certificate.
Did you have all those documents? Yeah, you're traveling all over the place. How do you hang on to papers like that?
I got the paper from the all country, and the police, they give me clearance that he didn't did anything wrong. He was been here for asylum, and then he go to other country, move to other country, so he's clear.
Has the election changed how you see America?
I feel different because, like, when I was in Germany, lots of people told me, stay here, you are lucky because you will get your documents here and you will have a good life. Don't go to America because Donald Trump will become and they will send you back to Afghanistan and you will lose your life.
Why didn't you stay in Germany?
Because I liked America, and America was like a freedom country for all people. And here is lots of respect, you know? So that was the reason I wanted to come to America.
Naz, the best of luck to you. And let me just say that we are very grateful for the work you did for the Marines in Afghanistan. Thank you for that, and thank you for the interview.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, a tough-talking anti-establishment populist candidate wins the White House. Nope, not Donald Trump. Think early 19th century.
Old Hickory, the hero of New Orleans, the champion of the common man, bloody, bloody Andrew Jackson, 7th president of the United States from 1829 to 1837, father of both the Democratic Party and arguably the father of modern politics.
Remembering Andrew Jackson, that's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Sunday marks the one-year anniversary of the terror attacks in Paris that left 130 people dead. In the immediate aftermath of those attacks, memorials to the dead and wounded began to appear at the attack sites. Parisians and visitors alike left tributes to the victims, piles of flowers and notes, messages of solidarity with the city of Paris. The Paris City Archive returned to the sites in the weeks and months that followed to collect those items, and now they become a permanent part of the archive. Reporter Emma Jacobs paid a visit.
Last New Year's Eve, I passed by the Bataclan Concert Hall, and a woman offered me a tea light. There were already dozens of candles burning, even more than a month after the Paris attacks. People continued to add to and tend these memorials into the spring. Some of the most touching items left were the most personal. Photographs and notes directly to the victims. Audrey Cezali is an archivist at the City of Paris Archives.
On a été un peu étonnés des fois au moment de la collecte. On voit il y a des messages qui ont été mis sur des tickets de métro, sur des.
We were a little astonished to find messages written on metro tickets, on business cards, on hamburger wrappings, and on postcards. We felt there was a sense of urgency. You're there, you leave a note.
There was an urgency to their work, too, preserving anything with a legible message before it was destroyed by the weather. Cezali says it's the first time she can remember collecting documents like this off the street. She and her colleagues made more than a dozen visits over the course of the winter and spring, carrying away papers and objects in cardboard boxes. They laid the documents out to dry and had them disinfected to kill paper-destroying microbes. Then they cataloged everyone.
We rarely work with contemporary documents about events that we are still living.
This could be emotionally difficult work, but her colleague Mathilde Panteau said they kept a professional distance. We wore two hats, she says, of Parisians, but also archivists who already do this work. I wanted to participate in this collection effort as a professional, but also because I was convinced that it was fundamentally important for the history of Paris as a citizen. Some of the objects left behind, like a painted guitar at the Bataclan, will go to a Paris history museum. As for the collected notes, they've all been scanned, and the archive staff is in the process of determining which ones can be shared online. Because of privacy concerns, some of the most poignant items left at the scene, the photos of the victims, won't be included. But here are a few of the messages. Je suis Paris, always together, always standing. At the concert, on the terrace, in the stadium. Thinking about you a lot. We love you very much. For the world, Emma Jacobs, Paris.
A lot of people have been saying the triumph of a man like Donald Trump is unprecedented in American history, but our history desk disagrees with that. Our historian-in-chief, Chris Wolf, is here to explain. So, Chris, who's on your mind?
Old Hickory, the hero of New Orleans, the champion of the common man, bloody, bloody Andrew Jackson, 7th President of the United States from 1829 to 1837, father of both the Democratic Party and arguably the father of modern politics.
All right, so what are the parallels?
Let's start with the hair. Well, we all know the face from the $20 bill, but take a look at that big unruly shock of hair.
What a pompadour that is.
It was red, just to give you a sense of the immediate parallel. But he was also extremely controversial, charismatic, combative, quick-tempered, unpredictable, showy, self-publicizing, and a genius of marketing.
Okay, so that's a fairly strong case. What about the differences, though?
Andrew Jackson, unlike Donald Trump, was very much the self-made man. He had been a poor orphan, but made his fortune first as a lawyer and then in real estate speculation. And then there's the undoubted courage he showed in the service of his country. He fought in numerous wars against the British, the Spanish, and various Native American peoples. And he got his nickname, Old Hickory, from repeatedly exposing himself to the enemy's fire and never getting hit. Now, he did get shot a couple of times while dueling and brawling, but not in battle against those various enemies.
Did Andrew Jackson have a lot of populist support?
He saw himself and was seen by the American people as the champion of the little man. He took the grievances of the little man, which were many, the ordinary farmer and the mechanic, and hurled them against what he called the aristocracy of the few, the established political elite of the East Coast cities, personified for Andrew Jackson by John Quincy Adams, a cosmopolitan diplomat, son of a president, John Adams. And he basically took the political establishment, shook it up and threw it out. So that part of his background is kind of similar to the Donald. But there's also another part of his background that's similar, the real estate speculation based on very controversial deals. He basically established a futures market in the lands of various Native American peoples, which was not actually up for sale. But he traded and obtained various plots of land. Eventually, part of this became the city of Memphis, which he founded in 1819. The other interesting parallel that people might like to know is that he was also the victim of the first deliberate smear campaign during the 1828 presidential election.
So how did Andrew Jackson actually do as president?
It depends whose history you read. Mm. He was semi-deified by the Democratic Party later in the 19th century. They even adopted a nickname of his as a badge of honor. The donkey that you see as the Democratic Party emblem
was a
deliberate play on his name. They called him Jackass Jackson in the 1828 election campaign. So he definitely shook up the political establishment. He was very responsive to public opinion. He was seen as a bit of a, what we'd call in Old England, a nutter. He was not someone you bluffed with. If he made a threat, you were pretty sure he could well carry that out, like he could push the button. And that helped him actually preserve the Union when South Carolina threatened to secede over a tariff reform. He made a pretty believable threat and eventually got the South Carolinians to back down. He did take on big business. He even shut down the central bank of the time, the Second Bank of the United States. But that led to a boom based on easy credit, which was followed by the inevitable crash, causing the worst depression that the country had ever seen up to that point, 4 years before there was any kind of recovery. But that largely got blamed on his successor. The much bigger blot to a lot of people's minds, especially in the 21st century, is the policy that was called back then Indian removal. There was tens of thousands of Native American people in both what's now the southern states and also the Midwestern states, as we call them now, that were basically forced to leave their ancestral homelands, and thousands died along the way. And, you know, there's an argument to be made, given the kind of interest that Jackson had in trading in those lands, that this was really in the interests of real estate speculation rather than national security. And some people have accused him of almost a genocidal action against Native Americans. And then Alexis de Tocqueville, the great narrator of American politics in the early 19th century, he was not impressed with Jackson at all. He just thought he was trading on his reputation as a general, and particularly highlighted his disregard for institutions and the law.
All right. I know you won't go reaching for straws, but do you think any of this Andrew Jackson history prefigures today?
Well, we can't possibly tell the future or what kind of president Donald Trump is going to be. I think the only real comparison is to say that Trump actually fits in to an established American political tradition of charismatic, populist, anti-establishment, proto-demagogues, let's call them, who periodically come along, shake things up, but don't necessarily leave the world a better place.
The World's One Man History Desk, Chris Wolf, thanks very much for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
Coming up, news headlines, and later, California schools go from one language to two. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on the world, remembering veterans and remembering Leonard Cohen.
If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
That's still ahead, right here on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's Veterans Day today, and this year it happens to fall in the same week as a significant and divisive election. We wanted to know how veterans are feeling about the results of the vote, so we reached out to our online community of vets, and always they got back to us quickly and with some strong responses. Mark Schermerhorn from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, texted us. He wrote, "Thank God Trump won." Other vets wanted to make sure the new president does something about health care for veterans. Phil Moyart of San Jose, California wrote, "Make America Great Again, reform the health care delivery services of the Veterans Administration." Also, there were some notes of concern. This one from Brian McGough. He's a veteran who served in the initial invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and was wounded in combat.
I, for one, am a little concerned. I did not see the election going the way it did. It kind of makes me a little upset about how my views of America are different than the views of America that are coming out right now. It's important to remember that there are a lot of veterans out there who are now feeling like they don't belong in this country. There are veterans of color, veterans of different religious preferences, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender veterans who now feel threatened in their own country. And for me, that's very concerning.
My name is Afrida Davis. I am a sergeant in the Army Reserves. I've been serving for almost 14 years. I've had one tour of service in Iraq. Veterans Day has always been a pretty difficult day for me, always feeling marginalized because of your veteran, the person that you know who served, doesn't look like me. And so there's always this fight to be seen and to be recognized on Veterans Day for me personally. But for this election to compound, you know, a candidate who has been so divisive against communities of color, I really don't have a whole lot of words. It's just really difficult to be in this fight and being recognized as a veteran, only to be further marginalized and set aside as a black person.
Afrida Davis was not alone in her concern about racism and marginalization, but Dean Castaldo, an 8-year military veteran, points out that the people who make up the armed services are a cross-section of America, and regardless of their differences, Castaldo says, they all work together as a team.
I think the American population can learn from that and take that on board, and everyone should, metaphorically speaking, raise their right hand and pledge to be part of something bigger than themselves and say, I'm an American first, and let's just all come together and work as a team and continue to do great things. You know, if you look throughout our history, we've endured much more difficult times. We've gone through civil wars and world wars and great depressions that the current population, we couldn't ever even imagine. And yet, here we are. You know, we'll be okay.
Thoughts from veterans on this Veterans Day 2016. A big thanks to everyone who texted us and shared their thoughts. If you'd like to join the community and help us with our coverage of vets, just text the word RETURN to 69866. That's RETURN to the number 69866. As candidate, President-elect Trump famously said he'd build a wall along the Mexican border and make Mexico pay for it. He said he'd deport up to 12 million undocumented immigrants and put on hold new arrivals from Syria. So will these plans materialize, and who's on the team advising Trump on all this? I've got Jude Joffe Block on the line. She's a reporter at station KJZZ in Phoenix. So who are some of the people being discussed to help Trump on immigration, Jude?
Well, we know that Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach has joined the transition team. He's been an immigration advisor to Donald Trump, and he has a long history of influencing Arizona policy when it comes to immigration as well.
How did he do that from Kansas? What did he do in Arizona?
He's credited as one of the authors of SB 1070. That was Arizona's immigration enforcement law that basically made a role for local police to question people about their immigration status, as well as made sure that sanctuary cities in Arizona could not exist. And so this is somebody who also authored Alabama's immigration enforcement law. Much of these laws, I should point out, were found to be unconstitutional. There's only sort of a one small part of SB 1070 in Arizona that's still in effect. He also authored a law in Arizona that requires proof of citizenship in order to register to vote. This was a way to ensure that immigrants who were not citizens would not be voting.
Well, as you say, Jude, the Supreme Court watered down the really controversial parts of SB 1070, but I'm wondering, with Kris Kobach on Donald Trump's team, should we expect seeing some kind of federal version of SB 1070 under Trump?
Right. It does seem like one of Kris Kobach's pet policies is the idea of using local police as part of immigration enforcement, which under the Obama administration had been really relegated to the federal level. We also know that Kris Kobach was an advisor to Mitt Romney, and he's been credited with the idea of self-deportation, with the idea of making things very difficult for immigrants to work and live to the point that they wind up wanting to leave themselves. We know that in terms of the Trump administration, he's been a big advocate for the wall and has been very confidently quoted saying that he's going to make sure that that happens.
One big local change for Arizona immigrants is that Joe Arpaio, who famously called himself America's toughest sheriff, was voted out of office on Tuesday. I mean, he kind of pioneered the racial profiling that was part of the original language of SB 1070, and he had 24 years in office. Tell us briefly about that upset, and has it changed the mood at all in Phoenix?
It's been a really interesting moment for immigrant rights advocates here in Arizona with the result that Arpaio lost and Trump won. There were many immigrants, undocumented people who participated in the movement to get Arpaio voted out of office. And so they celebrated his defeat, but at the same time, it was kind of overshadowed by the news that Trump, who wants to nationalize some of the very things that Arpaio attempted locally, would now be in office. What I heard from those advocates, though, was, well, maybe we've created a model of what immigrant activists can do. We were able to defeat Arpaio by organizing. Maybe we can organize and defeat some of Trump's immigration policies as well.
Reporter Jude Joffe Block with station KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
From Arizona to California now, where voters spoke up for bilingualism this week in a big way. 72% of voters passed Prop 58, overturning a nearly 20-year ban on bilingual education in the state. So what changed? I asked Patricia Gandara, professor of education at UCLA and co-director of the Civil Rights Project. She's been working on this issue for two decades.
The climate around immigrants, in addition to immigrant languages, has changed radically over the last two decades, as California has become comfortable with the idea that immigrants are actually an overall asset and their languages are potentially a great asset to the young people of this state.
I mean, there was Prop 227, which banned bilingual education, and that passed 4 years after California's passed a very racially charged Proposition 187, which prohibited immigrants who were illegally in the country from access to public benefits. I mean, something shifted in a major way. What do you think it was?
You know, during the period of time of Proposition 187 and 227, we had Republicans in the state house. We had a Republican government, and it was very fixated on a very conservative message about identity and who we are, and we're losing our identity, and we need to get rid of these people. And these languages are a problem for us. The leadership in the state changed, and along with a better economy, I think all those things together changed the general atmosphere in California.
Any parallels that you're seeing with the presidential election that we just went through this week?
You know, I'm finding a great irony in this presidential election, because obviously Donald Trump has been very anti-immigrant. He's really run his campaign from the very beginning on an anti-immigrant message. At the same time that California overturns the last vestiges of the laws that we had here that were really anti-immigrant, I think the country, and I would say this very optimistically, I think the country will come to the same place that California is in now, but it's probably going to take a little while. I hope it's not another two decades, but I think the rest of the country is dealing with what we dealt with 18 years ago.
So how quickly can dual language programs be expanded throughout California? And will there be schools that do English-Spanish, English-Chinese, English-Japanese?
We already have a lot of schools that do English-Vietnamese, English-Korean, English-Chinese. Those are increasingly popular. So yes, of course, there will be more of those. How long will it take for us to mount these programs? You know, when Proposition 227 passed, my biggest concern, I have to tell you, because I think it's very important to know that at that time, 29% of the children who were English learners who could have benefited from such a program were in a bilingual program. Overwhelmingly, the children in California who could benefit from these programs were not in them. And a primary reason for that was we didn't have the teachers. I would say that the biggest impact of Proposition 227 on the state has been the decimation of that teacher pool.
Yeah, so do you have enough qualified teachers for the program?
Absolutely not. We need policy in this state now to help incentivize this and to reward people for doing this work.
As you already said, Patricia, California is often seen as a bellwether state. But just in terms of bilingualism, how do you think Proposition 58 will affect other states where there are bans still on bilingual education, like right here in Massachusetts?
I believe it is going to have an impact there. We've had a lot of research over the last several years that shows the benefits of bilingualism, and they are myriad. There are economic benefits, social benefits, cognitive benefits. And now we have really strong research that shows educational benefits. In other words, the kids who are in these programs, if they're strong programs, those children are going to do better on English, tests of English, than the children who are in English-only programs. So I think all of the research that has mounted up over the last several years, and now with the passage of 58, I think this is going to become very convincing to the rest of the country.
Patricia Gandara, professor of education at UCLA and co-director of the Civil Rights Project, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Marco.
One more story on education now, this one about higher ed. You've probably heard about American universities going global, opening campuses overseas. But one of India's largest college chains is flipping the script. Amity University is based in New Delhi, but has campuses in 11 countries. And now Amity plans to open a campus in New York and had hoped to start one here in Massachusetts. But as WGBH's Kirk Carapeza reports, Massachusetts officials moved to block the plans.
By 2022, India will become the most populous country in the world, overtaking China. And that's creating something of a problem for kids trying to get into college there.
The top ones are extremely selective.
Jamshed Baruka is a distinguished fellow at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire.
Once you go one or two levels below them in terms of brand, the quality drops tremendously. They're not able to recruit faculty members who are good enough to challenge the students at this point. So it's a crisis in higher education.
A crisis that Amity University is trying to solve and capitalize on.
Admissions are open for MBA degrees at Amity University, India's most high-tech campus. Amity University has been ranked number one in India.
Yes. Since its founding in 2003, Amity has enrolled tens of thousands of students, offering them degrees in everything from fashion to food technology, marine biology to engineering. And not just in India, it's got a network of schools in 11 countries, including China, South Africa, Dubai, and Britain. In September, the university announced plans to enter the U.S. and it bought its first campus on Long Island. The school said it was also planning to buy two more campuses, including one here in Massachusetts. But it met local skepticism, most notably from Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. Even though Amity has a decent reputation as a nonprofit in India, she worried it would operate more like a predatory for-profit college in the U.S., and she called on the state's Board of Higher Education to block Amity from buying the New England Institute of Art just outside Boston.
We've had enough problems with these kinds of institutions. I don't think that we should be taking a flyer with an unlicensed, unaccredited entity from India that has no experience or track record providing education to students here in the U.S.
Amity refused to comment for this story, but university officials had said they planned to cater mostly to Americans, with some foreign students attending for short periods. In the UK, Amity has partnered with two universities to offer limited degrees. Officials there say the school has been working hard to get accredited on its own. That could be an uphill battle in the US. While many American colleges have successfully set up shop overseas, few foreign schools have been able to open branches here. Barmak Nazirian is with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities.
The United States tends to be viewed quite correctly as the leading nation when it comes to both the scale and the quality of its existing higher education infrastructure. So it would be kind of a tough sell for overseas institutions to come to, of all places, here, where we have so many institutions and so many great institutions. If it were Oxford University proposing to do this, I would take some solace from the fact that it's Oxford. But then I have to look at the other leg of this transaction, and I see Amity. That's very alarming.
Jamshed Baruka says Nazirian and Attorney General Maura Healey are being narrow-minded, and he says Amity should have been given a chance just like any other school.
The accrediting bodies will make the determination of quality, and the institution will rise or fall based on the academic reputation that it develops.
While Amity is reportedly backing off its plans to run a college here in Massachusetts, the university says it will open its New York campus next June. For The World, Kirk Carapeza, Boston.
As you know, it's Veterans Day here in the U.S. when we remember those who have served in the armed forces. Not to be confused with Memorial Day, which honors those who have died in service to our nation. Elsewhere, like in Britain and Canada, today is Remembrance Day, which is more like Memorial Day, a tribute to the fallen. In many countries, they wear red poppies on their lapels on this day, a nod to the poppies that grew in Flanders Fields in Belgium, the battlegrounds where many soldiers died in World War I. And since we're on the subject of remembrance and Flanders Fields, let's start by remembering someone who died, Leonard Cohen, age 82. In just a couple of minutes, some of his music and a story of his performance for Israeli troops during the 1973 Yom Kippur War. First, though, the voice of Leonard Cohen, for my money, one of the most evocative sounds ever in music. This is it in its pure form, Cohen reciting the famous World War I poem In Flanders Fields, written by another Canadian, John McCrae, in 1915. This is courtesy of Legion magazine.
In Flanders fields, the poppies blow. Between the crosses, row on row that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks, still bravely singing, fly. Scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved. And now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
Wow, that voice. The poem, In Flanders Fields, for you on this Veterans Day, recited a few years ago by none other than Leonard Cohen. Of course, it's Cohen's distinctive sound and style as a musician that we'll remember most.
I asked my father, I said, Father, change my name.
Yeah, it's a tough one. We have to add Leonard Cohen to the list of iconic musicians who've left us this year. Prince, David Bowie, Alan Toussaint. Cohen's name is often mentioned alongside a small circle of songwriting masters like Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, and Paul Simon. But Cohen managed to penetrate the rest of the world like no other. And one place that Cohen is revered is Israel. Most people believe he wrote this song, Lover, 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 during a trip there in 1973.
Yes, lover, 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 come back to me.
Earlier today, I spoke on the phone with Israeli singer Oshik Levy from the city of Herzliya. I mean, you're a key part of the story of how Leonard Cohen went to the Sinai to sing for Israeli troops in 1973. That was during the Yom Kippur War. But first, tell us how you actually met him, because he was in a cafe and you saw him, right, in Tel Aviv?
Yeah. I walk in Dizengoff and I go to my coffee that I sit there usually. And suddenly I see Leonard and another friend of mine, an actor, sitting there. And I ask him, excuse me, Mr. Leon, what are you doing here? He said that the Jewish people were in the war and I come to help. Then he wants to go to work in the kibbutzim to help. I said, leave the kibbutzim, you are a singer, I take you to perform. And he said, no, my song is very sad and very quiet. Anyway, I convinced him to come with me. And I invited another friend of mine, Matty Kaspi, he's a great musician. And I got to the stage, it's full of 1,000 soldiers, pilots, all over. And I said, listen, guys, I have a surprise for you. Mr. Leonard Cohen is here. All the audience shout. And he's very excited, and Matty Kaspi go and play with him together. And it was a very big surprise for them.
Yeah.
And after that, they want another show. So between the two shows, he wrote the song, Lover, 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 Come Back to Me.
Mm.
And he tells the story in this song. And since that two perform in that day, after we go down to Sinai and we perform between 6 and 8 performs a day. And I try to make it very convenient for him, maybe sleep in one of room in the base. And he said, no, 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 I want to sleep with all the soldiers. So we sleeping on a blanket in what we call shekem. It's a kind of cantina for a soldier on the floor. And all the night we talking about philosophy, Judaism, everything. And after that, every day we perform between 6 and 8 perform a day to the artillery and the Navy and the Air Force. And he asked each of them where we perform, how is it? I want to be a soldier. I want to be in the Air Force. He's so, you know, involved on the emotion in this situation until that Kissinger arrived. It's after a month, And he said, when the political came, I'm left. And that's it.
What a powerful moment for the soldiers in the Sinai. But, I mean, even today, 2016, everyone in Israel knows this story.
Yes.
What was it about this visit that made it such a powerful moment for Israeli history?
Make it very publicity because it's kind of, what can I tell you, a singer, a name like Leonard Cohen, so big, come here and perform during the war. Nobody do it. Nobody do it.
Leonard Cohen, obviously, he's Jewish. He writes songs and even kind of references Jewish scripture. What's the one piece of wisdom Leonard Cohen left you with that you hang on to today?
Wisdom of life. And the last record that I heard and the article that wrote about and that what he say, I'm ready to go now. And he put some Hebrew word, Hineni, Hineni, my Lord, I'm going. And Leonard Cohen is one of the stars in the sky that I remember.
Oshik Levy, thank you very much for speaking with us and remembering Leonard Cohen with us. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, thank you.
We'll close this week with one of my favorite Cohen tracks, Dance Me to the End of Love. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Have yourselves a great weekend.
Dance me to your beauty with a burning violin. Dance me through the panic till I'm gathered safely in. Lift me like an olive branch and be my homeward dove. Dance me to the end of love.
PRI Public Radio International.